tonight's topic is our favorite little stories. And I invited you to reflect on what stories are frequent visitors to your mind. And just to prime the pump, I'll reveal to you what some of mine are. I spend a great deal of time figuring out how to fix our political system. I tell lots of stories about the effect of greed and capitalism on our society. Issues of class, race, gender, and disability. And then I have a category of climate change stories. I can get pretty excited about waste versus conservation. I have definite opinions about science doubters. And I can go on for hours about our biomass or footprint and energy use and population. Then there's the what happens after we die. That's a fun story. I think part of my story is the opinion I have that it's really hard to change our notions of the afterlife after they're formed, and it's fairly early in life. And in fact, Buddha was raised in a culture that accepted reincarnation. And that's the way he told the story. And after all, he was a human being. But by far, my favorite stories are about me. Stories about things that happened in the past that still make me mad. Expectations for myself that I want to do something good for humanity. I'd like to be famous. Pretty much given up on being wealthy. And then I spend a lot of time dealing with explanations of my health or lack thereof, my various symptoms and what they might mean and why I have, you know, some genetic issues. And, you know, some of these stories are useful. Some of them make me more or less interesting at parties. The stories that I have about my health actually do have a function, a good one, because they focus around how my health issues limit my activities. And I am just naturally a very active person. I like to go and do. And a lot of what's been going on with my body for the last 20 years is I can't. You know, one thing after another has sort of fallen out of my range of abilities. And it's important for me to keep track of them because otherwise, if I went skiing, it could be a disaster. And, you know, backpacking is just not a good idea for me at this point. So I need to know what my limits are. The problem actually with all of the above stories is that even the socio-political ones, they're all about me. I'm the person telling the story. And I'm really holding on to that. And the fact that I've got this story right and other people don't makes me feel good about myself. Makes me feel good about myself. Just for a little while, though. What happens, for example, with the health stories is that after I reacquaint myself with my limits, then it becomes an exercise in self-pity. And I don't mean to judge self-pity. It's just a drag. It's not compassion for myself. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about what I have recently been told. The fellow who came up with the seven deadly sins called sloth or inactivity. It is a form of self-pity. It's feeling sad and discouraged so that you end up doing nothing. I think of it as a mental tar pit. You know, you touch it and it kind of grabs onto you the way it did, you know, in Los Angeles, their tar pits that have all the dinosaur bones in them. It's hard to get out of that once you go in. So it's a form of suffering. And most of these repetitive stories that we all have, maybe they have like the kernel of usefulness, but usually when they're about me, I or mine, they involve suffering and a fair amount of it. And I'll start at the beginning, which was my going to Yosemite and finally stopping in the right place as you go around this long oval of a circle to sit comfortably and just watch Yosemite Falls. In the process of watching it, I realized that over the years I've taken photographs of Yosemite Falls. And there it is, right? No. Because as I sat there and actually watched it, I realized it was water falling. It's not a thing, a place, but it's an event. It's an ongoing event. And, you know, I don't think the water has ever run out, but if you go in the autumn, it's very different than it is in the spring. And moment by moment, it's different. And it just made me very aware of how we do tend to take snapshots of events. In fact, we live in a world that's constructed by these snapshots. We live in a world of concepts. We see something happen and we give it this sort of mental shorthand, which is very helpful. But it means that when we put it all together, and we've been working on this since day one out of the womb, of constructing this way of dealing with what comes at us in life. And we're human beings. A lot of our experience is other human beings who collectively have created, by using concepts and analytical thinking, they've created this world that is almost independent of the world our distant ancestors lived in. And we now refer to that world as nature. They didn't have anything to call it, it just was. But we're in this kind of artificial, man-made environment now. And within that, we have this artificial, conceptual environment that we have constructed with all our ideas of what happens after I die, Mommy, to, you know, which fork do I pick up first at a formal dinner party, to is it rude to do this or that? How do I help somebody who's in need? We get an answer, we plug it into where it belongs in our conceptual framework, and it's very helpful. And sometimes, with the more complicated things, we need to run stories. As I was saying about my health issue, it was helpful to remember what my limits are, blah, blah, blah. But really, over and over, for hours in a day, there's something wrong with the picture when that happens. And these are the stories I'm talking about. The ones that are repetitive, they don't leave us feeling good. in order to understand them and to free ourselves from this, I've often called it the hamster wheel of the mind. To get off the hamster wheel, we have to stop and look at what's happening in the moment, what our experience is as we're telling the story, as we're listening to it, because we're our own captive audience with these stories. In other words, we've got to stop thinking of us and our whole world as nouns, as things, and recognize that we're verbs, we're events, we're a process. And it takes stopping and doing what we do when we meditate, to just be with it, watch it, look closely, what's going on. And this is the way we get out of delusion. I mean, Buddhism, people always say, oh, if you're a Buddhist, you believe it's all illusion. No, no. The correct quote is that we live in delusion because we're not in direct contact with what's going on, with the event aspect of our experience. And unless we are, we have no hope of ending our suffering as a result of the delusion. Thinking based on concepts will continue to go around and around because there is one central concept. It's like a black hole in the universe that sucks things into it, and that's the concept of self. And that's what causes us to cling to all of this mental space junk in our mind. If you want to know the truth about something, you have to watch it happen as it's happening. And I'm talking about the spiritual truth. There's an article that I really like by Tanissaro Bodhi. He's one of the outstanding scholars of our age. It's on the appropriate attention to bring to the present moment. He says, suffering is something directly knowable. It is private, but universal, and it is not dependent on words or definitions. He calls it pre-verbal, what suffering is. We know what it is, but even Buddha didn't put it into words. Sit and watch it. You'll know. Buddha did give us a basic handle on this non-conceptual phenomenon, and that is clinging. Look for our clinging. Where is the me in the story? Why is it I can't let go of this story? Clinging isn't all there is to suffering, but it's really useful. It's the most useful aspect of suffering for the purpose of ending the suffering. Now, it may be confusing to you that I'm going to be talking about using concepts in order to get out of delusion. A lot of people think, well, I'm supposed to just not have thoughts running in my mind while I'm meditating, and yet, Rebecca, now you're recommending that I think about what happens in meditation. Well, Tanissaro Bodhi goes by the nickname Tan Jeff, and this article does a pretty good job of explaining why we need to do that and how we need to do it. He says that we need a particular type of tool to understand the genesis of suffering. And those tools allow us to question where our past understandings and misunderstandings have come from, and to ponder what's happening right in the moment. We need a type of analysis that will ferret out the connections between what's happening and how it affects us. You remember during the meditation, there was a dog out there and some voices, and maybe they were annoying, and I piped up and said, "What's important isn't our experience, but our response to it." So this is the kind of conceptual analysis that we need to bring to practice in order for our meditation to free us from suffering. Tan Jeff says, "You have to learn to watch your own desires and aversions carefully and honestly to tell which kind they are." And although the patterns that underlie our desires and our suffering might be tangled, we can learn about them and we can master them. And the way we learn about them is to watch. Get your folding chair, sit down across from Yosemite Falls, and sit there for an hour and a half and watch it. Or be in the meditation hall. Notice when the yapping dog or the voices make you irritated. If there's a story that goes along with it, a common one of mine is, "They should know we're meditating in here. Maybe I should get up and go yell at them." And then there's the story, "Oh, wouldn't that make me look like an enlightened teacher if I did that?" And just notice, you know, where is the suffering in this for me? Our practice is much more than sitting and watching the breath and feeling serene, although there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, and it helps a lot. Tan Jeff says, "You can't treat everything in the present moment in the same way. You can't simply stay non-reactive and just accept anything. If moments of stillness and ease arise, learn to develop them." And he suggests using that to develop your concentration, to stay with the breath longer, and it results in just an exquisite pleasure. Make it your friend. When mental suffering arises, you can't just let it go. You should focus whatever powers of concentration and discernment you have to comprehend the clinging that lies at its heart. When mental suffering arises, you can't just let it go. You should focus whatever powers of concentration and discernment you have to comprehend the clinging that lies at its heart. So in other words, if you're suffering, the cause of the suffering is in the mind and heart. We always want to say, "I'm upset because that person said X, Y, and Z. That person said X, Y, and Z." On a different day, it might not have upset us. But in that moment, it caused a response. And our practice is to look at why. And the first way to look at it is to feel the response. Know how the body responds to yapping dog, to thought about going and yelling at the woman, to whatever is arising in that moment. How do we feel? This is suffering. The conceptual tools that Tom Jaff are talking about are, what is suffering? How do we know what suffering is? We feel it. How do we feel it? We listen to Rebecca in the instructions when she says, notice how it makes you feel and compare it to how you feel when you're not thinking, when you're just serenely present with the sensations of breathing. You're not suffering when you're mindful. When you're thinking, 99.999% of the time, you're suffering. And particularly when it's one of those hamster wheels that's happening. They're there because you can't let go of them. What's the key word? Clinging. Who's clinging? I am. And remember, I is one of those concepts, one of those stories. And we have to keep telling ourselves stories about who and what we are. If we stop, it starts to kind of float away. It's a delightful feeling. It's scary at first. And sometimes we need to pause. It's just been my experience in retreats. When I've stopped thinking about myself, myself will have a backlash. And I'll need to sit it on my knee and hold it. And tell it, I'm not trying to get rid of you. I just want to be able to see through you. Because you make a better door than window sometimes. So nothing wrong with the self if we don't take it at its own word all the time. Because remember, a lot of these stories, their truthiness factor is not that great. What I've been doing in teaching about mood and repetitive stories, soon I'm going to talk about attitudes and views that we cling to, is I'm trying to point to the way that we can do the kind of analysis that Tom Jaff is talking about, to find out what is suffering and then what caused it. Look for the clinging. And what ends it? And if with these repetitive stories, they're a great thing to look at because we get to look at them over and over, and eventually we start to see the patterns. We start to see, oh, yeah, I'm thinking that, and that's the way it makes me feel. And somebody talked about early childhood lessons, things that we were told about ourselves, about our world. They start to make sense, and we begin to really understand why this story won't leave our minds. And then we begin to understand what ends the suffering. So the fourth noble truth is the tools, this analytical toolkit that we have of the Eightfold Path. And that's what all of us teachers are trying to provide you with time after time. It's the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the tools to deal with whatever phenomenon is going on in your mind right now that plagues you. If you're fine with it, it's probably not making you suffer too badly because we're pretty used to suffering. We do it all the time. But as our practice goes on, we may find that the things that we thought were perfectly good stories really have that rub to them. Maybe then we want to explore them. So when these phenomena come up that have the rub to them, the suffering, work them. Use this effort to analyze it and to identify how to end states of mind that are suffering and how to sustain states of mind that are beyond joy. Happiness, you know, it just sounds like we're glad about something. talking about something that's always accessible to us and that is completely free of suffering. And if you want a little more elucidation about it, you might go on our website and listen to a Dharma talk I gave called Beyond Joy. Just in the mundane things of life, finding bliss, a delight in being alive. Thank you.